Tuesday is here. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore on 90.5 WKAR. What is happening here this Tuesday? Michigan Medicaid expansion signed into law yesterday by Governor Snyder. That'll take effect early next year. Michigan State basketball ranked number one in the country by Blue Ribbon College Basketball Yearbook. Michigan is at number nine. And what else? Lansing's Cristo Rey Community Center has a new executive director, Joe Garcia, a former MSU employee, now a business owner, according to the State Journal's Kevin Grasha. And Mr. Garcia, according to the story, pledges to be spiritually generous and fiscally responsible. And there, Mr. Garcia, you may have discovered the secret of the universe. We congratulate you and good luck. It is Current State here on WKAR at the top of the program. For more than 30 years, our first guest has sought to end suburban sprawl and urban disinvestment, both in American cities and around the world. Andres Duany is credited with advancing the design aesthetic known as New Urbanism. He's an architect and community planner whose firm, Duany Plater Zyberg, headquartered in Miami, has completed designs for almost 300 new towns, regional plans, and community vitalization projects. Officials and stakeholders in Michigan cities can hear Mr. Duany speak this Thursday in Detroit at the annual conference of the Michigan Municipal League. I spoke with Mr. Duany yesterday. He explained that new urbanism works differently from place to place.
You know, I believe you're from Lansing.
Correct.
And I've never been there, although I've been in Michigan. And I think that the answer about, you know, what new urbanism does is to contextualize the problem. Like, for example, if you are a relatively rural community, you know, that's the spirit of it, and the majority of the people prefer to live in houses, you know, because that's your culture, then what the new urbanism would say is go ahead, live in your houses, you know, have your cars, but also have, you know, mix up the incomes a bit, so that the people who mow the lawn and the people who run the companies, you know, basically people who need each other, are not too far, and try to get your ordinary daily needs within walking distance. You know, if you could get some groceries so that people could age in place, or that something like 50% of Americans don't drive because they're too young or too old or too poor, they should have a right to walk to their ordinary daily needs, you know, to have them within walking distance.
Okay.
And that's all the new urbanism would do. Now, if you're in a place like California that is absolutely choked in traffic, right, already,
mm-hmm.
terrible, then you would say, or they're in a bowl like Utah, you know, where the automobile pollution is terrible. It's causing a kind of overcast, permanent overcast. Then you say, okay, I think you have to ratchet this up, and everything possible should be done so that public transit will work. You know, so that people can take buses and trains and so forth. And that would require a density of something like 14 units to the acre to support it, because that's what that's about, you know. So I think new urbanism, the thing to remember is that while there are some hard and fast rules, they're always adjusted to local circumstance. You know, because in the end, what we're in it for is human happiness. You know, this is not a movement that's primarily environmental. It's not a movement that's primarily about, you know, making developers money. It's a movement about saying, how can we increase the sum of human happiness by actually fitting people to their environment better than suburban sprawl does, giving them more choice.
Now, your presentation at the Michigan Municipal League gathering on Thursday is actually about what's labeled lean urbanism. How does new urbanism and lean urbanism differ?
Well, new urbanism, which began in 1980, has been through different phases as it became mature, as it grew. And its current manifestation, the so-called next gen of new urbanists, are very local in their attitude. You know, they're part of the millennials is that they work locally. And many of them are not interested in engaging policy decisions and so forth. They just want to sort of make their communities better. And so lean urbanism is a way of saying, let's lighten up on the red tape let's lighten up on how long it takes to do things to enable the young generation to act. You know, just like when we were 30 years old and bureaucracy was so much lighter than it is now, we got some pretty great things done. So what we're trying to get at here is whatever is impeding smaller and more local and essentially younger people from acting, that we need to clear that out. Because there are 80 million millennials, and we can't wait for them to become experts in what, you know, in the national bureaucratic mess that we have. I'm not talking about politics. This isn't right-left, okay? This isn't about the politics, which is another kind of mess. This is pure bureaucracy. This is the stuff that survives whether you get a Republican president or a Democratic president.
Right.
What it does is it delivers the entire system to big professional expert firms and to lawyers. And the young people are totally turned off by this.
What principles of lean urbanism or new urbanism can be applied to a situation or to a landscape as dire as Detroit's or Flint's?
Well, actually,
or are your ideas better suited for smaller communities?
No. In fact, it's so funny that, of course, the whole world is talking about Detroit. But think about why the young people are flocking to Detroit. And they're renovating houses, and they're moving into places, and they're starting businesses, and they're starting farms. You know why they're going to Detroit? Because the bureaucracy has fallen apart, so they can act. Detroit is front and center example of lean urbanism. You see, it's the kids who are going to Detroit from all over America are going there because they can't get anything done back in their communities because they're being choked by bureaucracy. So Detroit is the test case for lean urbanism. And we are going to have a conference in Detroit in about 3 weeks, the so-called lean urbanists, not to teach Detroit anything, but to learn from Detroit, to meet some of these people who in their 20s and 30s are doing amazing things.
You're saying that Detroit went from a code red situation to a code pink situation just out of necessity because of its awful circumstances.
Actually, that's a very good, I might quote you. Code red and code pink. Perfect.
Our city's challenge, Lansing's challenge for many years, was the downtown became a ghost town in the evening. And I'm sure you've encountered this many times over the years. The situation's definitely improved significantly. We've attracted big businesses, and we've redeveloped our downtown riverfront. And there's a minor league baseball stadium downtown that brings people downtown. What do cities in that situation, what can they do to keep evolving?
Well, okay, I bet that virtually everything you did was what I call in the tail end of the 20th century. You know, and by the way, the 20th century ended in 2008. It didn't enter and end in the 00 period. You know, centuries don't end at 00. You know, for example, the 19th century ended in 1914, you know, the First World War, right? And what happened was that the first 7 years of the 20th century, of the 21st century, were really the tail end of the 20th. And we were an incredibly rich country. Now, a lot of the wealth was artificial, but it was there. And we were able to do things like public-private partnerships. So when you look at everything that you did in those years, you know, and you mentioned the baseball field, you mentioned the big corporations, they were all either public-private partnerships, which essentially are subsidized, or they were straight subsidized, right? Which is to say that there was a lot of public money. Well, now there isn't any public money. We're back to a totally new condition, which I call the reality of the 21st century. You know, it began in 2008. So you can't do it that way anymore. And lean urbanism is a direct response to this problem. It's a response that says, okay, there's no public money for subsidy, but there's all this energy, this young energy, the energy of the unemployed, who are not basically, you know, developers, the energy of the young, who, you know, don't know how to deal with bureaucracy. And by the way, don't forget the immigrants. The immigrants have an incredible energy. They have a lot more energy than just picking fruit and being janitors. Okay, these are people who come from countries that always built for themselves. If you give them a chance between the immigrants, the young people, and basically the unemployed, they can all work for themselves if they're not choked by what has become the American bureaucratic monster.
We're talking with Andres Duane, who is in Detroit here on Thursday at the annual convention of the Michigan Municipal League to talk about lean urbanism. You've become something of a prognosticator of what America might be like in the future. Can you give us a couple of your more daring predictions for American cities in the next 20 to 30 years?
You know, I'm an architect. And I used to actually have to think ahead about 5 years, you know, because between the time you're commissioned for the building and the time it's occupied and so forth, it's, you know, 3 to 5 years. And when I started being an urbanist and I realized that our first projects were being completed 30 years later, okay, you know, that's when they're running all. So even if you start right now, they're running all cylinders, you know, a generation later. So it gradually become accustomed to looking at a 15-year-old and saying, aha, that kid's going to be 45 years old, right? And you begin looking to the future almost obsessively. Like the present is a distortion field. So when you ask, what are the prognostications for the future? What I know about this country is that it was able to house 30 to 40 million immigrants without a penny in the latter half of the 19th century. Basically, they didn't have a banking system, and yet they built tremendous wealth through what essentially was management expertise and government with a very light hand. You know, they laid out, I mean, just take the Mormons. The Mormons, in 50 years, laid out about 530 new towns and cities in 50 years, and not one of them failed. And by the way, some of them are quite large, like San Diego. I mean, that's a Mormon outfit. Las Vegas is another. So you look at these people and you say, Americans can be very, very organized and create wealth out of nothing if you kind of leave them alone, if you don't distort it. So I must say, I've become a kind of libertarian, you know, not a right-wing sort, but simply I'd say, I think you need to trust people to do more for themselves. Because I think wealth has evaporated. You know, the wealth that we built over the last 300 years, we have actually shoved at the oil-producing countries. You know, if you go to Emirates or you go to Dubai or whatever, or you go to Saudi, they're building fantastic everything. Like, they have airlines of hundreds of brand-new airplanes, and they have incredible airports and incredible transit systems and all the high-rises. And you look at that and you say, hey, that's American wealth. We've taken the wealth we've built in the last couple of hundred years patiently and shoved it essentially at the Arab countries. We've shoveled it out. So now we're poor. And I think what Detroit and Pontiac and all these other cities have to confront is that there's no money to throw around. And that's a permanent condition. It isn't the real estate bubble that's going to go away. You know, we're going to recover from the real estate bubble. But what it revealed was an underlying impoverishment that means we have to be a lot smarter with our money. That's the number one prediction. I don't permit myself to have ideas anymore that cost money. You know, they have to pay for themselves. Not interested in, you know, in anybody subsidizing anything, because it ain't going to be done. That's 20th century thinking. The second thing I think we should know, if you believe in climate change, and I do, there's no evidence we're going to beat it. You know, there's all the indicators are going wrong. There's a new report coming out, you know, probably this week. The indicators are all taking a dive. You know, everything is worse. There's more carbon everywhere. And if you've been to China and if you've been to India and even if you've been to Italy, you realize, or Russia, they have no intention whatsoever of complying with Kyoto as a people. The government can sign anything they want, you know, in terms of a treaty. But the people aren't going to do a damn thing. I mean, they're growing at 20, 30 million a year just to begin with, you know, and each human is a disaster, you know. So one of the things I'm looking at is if climate change cannot be stopped, even if the worst parts are put off 100 years, it's going to be a very depressing circumstance psychologically. There's going to be a whole new take on the future, on the world, on the value of doing things, on the value of just having fun, on the value of, let's say, looking at the place becoming much less secure, you know, in terms of crime, you know. People get poor, people begin robbing each other. And so I'm beginning to think about a great demoralization, you know, in which you say, wow, it's curtains for for Western culture, not the human race, but Western culture. It's curtains. How are we going to deal with it? And one of the things that I think raises your spirit is, instead of mitigation, which requires a worldwide investment, you know, everybody acting together, you can do adaptation. Adaptation is what you can do locally. You can prepare your local community for what's coming. You can bring agriculture nearby so that, you know, when the strawberries don't fly in from Chile anymore, you have strawberries. You can actually have power generation, which you might be solar. Now, don't do solar because it's good for carbon. Do solar, you know, on your house, because if there's a brownout, you know, if the big grid collapses, you can still keep operating. You keep people doing the right thing. You know, you keep people bringing agriculture nearby. You keep people concerned about renewables and so forth. But the explanation isn't we're going to fix the world's climate. It's not that, because I think, as I said, as the news gets worse and worse, we're not going to believe in it anymore. And to avoid a great moral collapse, you need to say, yes, but you can work locally.
Very interesting.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I do.
Now, this happens to be doing the right thing. It happens to be almost exactly the same checklist, doing the right thing, but you present it differently. We're circling the wagons. It's myself and my community, and the hell with the Chinese, and the hell with the Indians, and the hell with the Arabs. You know, they can do their own stuff. I'm taking care of my community because actually what I do matters.
Andres Duany is the founder and partner in the architectural firm Duany Plater Zyberg. He's a longtime proponent of new urbanism, and you can hear Mr. Duany speak Thursday in Detroit at the annual conference of the Michigan Municipal League. Water attracted early settlers to Detroit, and water fueled its growth. Now, it's an important asset to the city's recovery. Today, Current State continues to explore Detroit's waterfront, challenges and opportunities in our series, Detroit's Water Renaissance. So far, we've looked at lucrative walleye fishing on the Detroit River, daylighting streams, and rebuilding shorelines. Today, we explore the Rouge River. The Rouge in Detroit is one of Michigan's and the Great Lakes' most polluted waterways. Generations of air and water pollution from heavy industry near the mouth of the river contaminated its sediments and made it unsafe for fishing. Upstream, dense urban populations have overwhelmed sewer and stormwater systems, sometimes dumping raw sewage into the Rouge. The result is a river in trouble. And as independent producer Karen Schaefer reports, residents in the neighborhoods that surround the industrial Rouge have suffered along with the river.
It's a steamy summer day at Bellinger Park in greater southwest Detroit, and a score of fishermen are hauling in silver bass from the Detroit River as fast as they can catch them. Posted on railings along the river are signs warning fishermen not to eat the fish more than once a week. Kevin Brown, a lifetime resident of nearby River Rouge, says he'll eat his catch from the Detroit River, but he won't fish in the Rouge.
Too many factories and stuff around there. Not that I keep them, but I don't even think I'd want to touch them.
Brown is right. It's not safe to eat most fish from the Rouge River, which empties into the Detroit just a few hundred yards upstream from the park. Industrial chemicals like polychlorinated biphenyls, better known as PCBs, are still abundant in the sediments of the Rouge from generations of manufacturing. In fact, this park near the river's mouth is surrounded by industry, from the smokestacks of steel mills and power plants to acres of oil storage tanks and vast piles of coke and iron ore.
If it was me, I wouldn't live here. Just all the smoke, even from Edison's here, it's ridiculous. I've lived here for 29 years, and I don't think it's ever going to change, really. I really don't.
The Rouge's industrial history began with the making of metal products like stoves from ore shipped in from the upper Great Lakes. That nexus of raw materials, shipping, manufacturing, and labor made Detroit an ideal location for the nascent auto industry. By the time Henry Ford opened his Ford Rouge plant in 1928 on 2,000 acres along the Rouge River, the Motor City was already well on its way to becoming the center of U.S. automaking. But along with industry and jobs came pollution.
you know, anybody that owns an automobile, anybody that lives in a manufactured house with building materials is really responsible for the pollution that is in the Rouge River.
Oren Gelderloos has been teaching environmental studies for almost 40 years at the University of Michigan in Dearborn, just a few miles up the Rouge on Henry Ford's former estate. Gelderloos says in the decades before environmental regulation, all kinds of pollutants were going straight into the river.
There were the waste materials like oils that came out of the plants, sludge materials, slag materials that could get dumped into the river.
With the passage of the 1972 Clean Water Act and industrial regulation, much of that pollution was curtailed. But oil spills still occur. In 2002, a waste oil hauler illegally dumped as much as 250,000 gallons into the Rouge, prompting a $7 million cleanup. In addition to industrial pollution, the Rouge faces an ongoing challenge from overflowing urban sewage. Here at Detroit's sole wastewater treatment plant, the largest in the Great Lakes, thousands of herring gulls are nesting along the lagoons. Robert Burns says this plant has long been a major source of pollution.
Back in 2009 till about 2011, the plant was out of compliance, and the plant basically was backing up like a toilet.
Robert Burns is the Detroit Riverkeeper, a nonprofit group that monitors threatened rivers. He says at one time, the city had 78 outfalls where raw sewage could spill directly into the river during heavy rains. Many have been shut down, but he says the sheer volume of water this plant mistreat makes it difficult and expensive to fix.
You got to understand that the Detroit wastewater treatment system services 3.8 million people and dozens of communities around the metro area.
In addition to polluted water, air pollution from industry and from the thousands of cars and trucks that daily cross the Rouge along I-75 into Canada is another major threat to residents and the river. At the mouth of the Rouge lies Zug Island.
We're passing the DTE Rouge power plant on the south side of the river and Zug Island on the north side. And large coal piles belong to EES Coke, which is a coke making facility, which leases property from U.S. Steel, which runs the steel mill on the other end of the island.
Crisscross tangles of iron scaffolding, pipelines, even the sheet metal that lines the water's edge are black with generations of coal dust. Looming above us is the massive sooty beehive furnace that turns coal into coke for the making of steel.
I even worked over in the mill at one time down at Zug Island. I know the pollution firsthand.
Clinton Cooper is a lifetime resident of River Rouge. These days, he owns a small clothing store on Jefferson, the city's main thoroughfare.
You can go in there white and come out my color. I noticed one winter, the snow down here actually turned orange from the pollution. And I think that's the reason why a lot of the sickness is so prevalent down here. A lot of the asthma. My grandboy's got asthma. A lot of people have a lot of symptoms.
According to the Michigan Department of Community Health, Detroit adults suffer from asthma at rates 50% higher than the rest of the state. And Detroit has the largest population of children with asthma in the country. Cancer is also a concern for many residents. Charles Stokes is a community organizer with Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice. He says a few years ago, a public campaign demonstrated just how many residents here have been diagnosed with cancer.
Everyone in this community who was affected by cancer, some form of cancer, was to put a yellow cross on their lawns. And on average, it was every other house.
Cancer, asthma, sewage, and industrial pollution. The Rouge and its residents face many challenges. But as bad as it is, many who live here believe the Rouge can and must be saved. For WKAR and Great Lakes Echo, I'm Karen Schaefer in Detroit.
This story was produced by Current State and Great Lakes Echo with support from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. We continue our series next Tuesday by looking at the impact of Detroit's industrial past on the Rouge River. Its current state on WKAR, Michigan's film industry has seen a few changes over the past 5 years. Under Governor Jennifer Granholm, refundable tax credits for films were unlimited. For the 2012 fiscal year under Governor Snyder, a cap of $25 million was placed on film incentives. The following year, the cap was increased to $50 million. Margaret O'Reilly is the director of the Michigan Film Office. She told Current State's Emmanuel Berry that despite the changes to Michigan's incentive program, producers are still looking to work in the state.
We continue to have one of the most lucrative incentive programs for the film industry in the country. We have put some parameters around it by having the $50 million cap on it, which gives us some certainty in how much we're going to spend and helps us manage our money rather than an open-ended process. But as a result of the $50 million we got for fiscal year 13, the current fiscal year, which ends October 1st of 13, we had 42 applications come in. About 75% of those have been small independent films. We've still been able to attract some of the big Hollywood titles as well, like the Transformers. Big Hollywood talent like Ryan Gosling brought his first film production that he's directing, How to Catch a Monster, to Detroit. So I think that we've been able to do a combination of things that we feel are important, and that the $50 million certainly gives us a nice amount of money to indicate to Hollywood that we're interested in you bringing your investment here, and we can attract still with that level all size films.
Has the fact that Michigan has gone from having $115 million, kind of an unlimited budget in 2010, to just $25 million shortly after that, and now we're around $50 million in the budget, I guess, has that sent a message at all of inconsistency to producers or for the state's reputation for filming?
Well, I think that maybe initially there was some uncertainty about it, but I've been in this position now almost a year, and I would say that we've stabilized that message. And the fact of the matter is the law itself, which is the act that determines the percentages and how much a production might be eligible to collect, is in place and doesn't expire until January of 2017. It's just how much every year is going to be allocated to that program. And that'll continue to be an annual debate. We've been upfront with Hollywood about that. When I first got into this position, we made a concerted effort to reach out to many of the large production studios, as well as many independent producers who had a track record of doing projects in Michigan, to let them know that we had funding. Please consider bringing your production here. We believe we have a good combination of talent, locations, and infrastructure available, coupled with our incentive program. It's turned out to be a winning package.
So how does Michigan's film incentive program, I know you mentioned that, you know, it's very generous at the beginning, but how does that compare to other states?
The maximum that a film could get would be up to 35% on some of their Michigan expenditures, and that would be depending on if they use a qualified Michigan facility, whereas compared to most other states, some of the ones that do have unlimited programs but cap it at 30%, for example, or like other states, I believe North Carolina has a per project cap that a project can't exceed. So there's different tools that different states use to manage their program, but with $50 million, we've been able to attract investment. Some of the top movies that have come out, we've been able to get Transformers here. A good chunk of their production happened here. Need for Speed was here. They did a portion of their movie in Detroit, and it's going to be very clear that they're going through Detroit. After all, it is a car movie. We've been able to attract, as you are well aware, recently, the Superman Batman upcoming untitled Warner Brothers investment. And so I think that even at $50 million, it still gives us obviously enough money, I believe, to attract what we want to do by having Hollywood productions still know we're here and come here and bring productions here, as well as our independent filmmakers.
How many applications do you get per year for films?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I think that as you've asked, we've cut the money, so are we not getting as much interest? If you look on how that compares, I believe the year that we spent $115 million on this program, we got about 60 applications. We got 42 this year with 50. So even though we have half the money or less than half the money, we still have two-thirds of the number of applications that are coming in. So I think that's, again, proof that we're still utilizing our money and spreading across a wide, diverse type of projects, large ones, smaller ones, Michigan-based ones, ones that support the Michigan industry.
So in looking at the range from these big blockbusters mm-hmm. to these smaller films, I guess, how do you decide which ones are going to bring the most benefit to the state?
If you look at our law, it lays out several factors that we look at when we are reviewing applications for approval. It looks at things like the jobs, the track record of the production company, and our level of comfort that they're going to complete the film and be able to finance the film. It looks at how much they're going to use Michigan companies. Obviously, it looks at many different factors, including if the production were going to happen here or not without the incentive. So we kind of look at those. We look at the order they come in. We look at the projects that use Michigan crew, use Michigan vendors, and services, and have most of their investment here in the state for their whole project. Those are the ones we really like. Mm-hmm.
A lot of these bigger movies, at least, and even movies like Ryan Gosling's, are being filmed in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about why Detroit is an attractive backdrop for these films.
Technically, there's an issue with some of the major production companies that want to utilize the crew in Detroit that has a track record of working with productions and some of their union contracts that have a 30-mile radius. So there's naturally an issue there that sometimes we hear that productions obviously want to stay within that 30-mile radius. Otherwise, it triggers some other cost to their production. But I do think that we are working hard to try and have productions look across the state toward investments in other parts of the state. We've had several productions, two or three different productions, independent ones up north, Traverse City. We have one up in the UP, I believe. We've had interest from, I believe, Transformers did some scenes here in Lansing during their production. So I think it's a matter of getting the message out to the productions that we support all of them from across the state. And they come to us and say, we're looking for this. What might you have available? And we kind of go with what they're looking for, but then also say, but you know, there's these other areas as well. And obviously, from a production's perspective, the more that a production travels, the more time it is, sometimes the more cost it is. So I think that from a management perspective, they like to keep it a little more condensed. But obviously, we're making sure they know that there's a lot to offer in Michigan, and it is a big state.
Who's Michigan's biggest competitor?
It depends on how you look at it. I would say that probably the states that get the most business out of Hollywood, besides California, New York, which mm-hmm. still continue to get, they're kind of the traditional old line productions, and that's where a lot of the industry continues to be. Louisiana and Georgia and North Carolina, Michigan, Chicago is getting a lot of business, but I believe we still have had more investment than Chicago this past fiscal year. But I don't know for certain. I'd have to look at the exact numbers. Back a few months ago, we were certainly on track for that. So I would say those are our biggest competitors. If you're looking at where does Hollywood spend more money? Those are probably the states that we hear the most about.
What other areas or other projects would you like to see more investment in?
Well, we, in addition to the continuation of independent films and major movie productions, we'd continue to like to see, or we're trying to push and grow more of the video game development, mobile application, digital media, type of industry and post-production industry. 5% of our funding legislatively is mandated to be used on post-production activities. So we naturally have some monies available for projects that do that, and we're trying to get some of these projects to do their post-work here. But in addition to that, the whole video game development is a real opportunity for the state. We have great resources here from our educational institutions, including Michigan State, and they have a game development program, as well as Ferris State, College for Creative Studies in Detroit. Henry Ford's got a lab down there, Henry Ford Community College. Northwestern Michigan College up north has an animation program. There's just a number of universities that are in this arena, a lot of students graduating from Michigan that want to go into this industry. It's a natural fit for a computer science major to go into video game development, and that is the type of production that is eligible to apply under our program. So we've made that a priority this past fiscal year. We've been able to increase our investment in that area from the previous fiscal year by, you know, over 200%. So we're pretty happy with that. We'd like to see that trend continue. And, you know, we want to help with the brain drain of some of those computer science majors and those video game people wanting to move out to San Francisco. We've got a couple companies here that have moved back or have moved to Michigan from San Francisco. Cost of living's less here, a great workforce to choose from, great quality of life for their families. So we think that's a real opportunity as well.
Critics of Michigan's incentive program have argued that Michigan's giving more money that they're getting back and that local talent or local businesses aren't being utilized. Do you think that's the case?
I don't believe that's true. Number one, our program is naturally designed to provide more money to productions that use Michigan people versus non-Michigan people. And again, I talked about that percentage going down. It'll continue to go down till it zeros out in a couple years completely. We also have a percentage for using Michigan vendors, Michigan service providers, Michigan businesses to help support a production. And I don't think it's just the independents that are doing that. Even the big movies are doing that. Superman reported, as you know, or we reported through our office, they're going to use, you know, 500 small businesses, 6,000 extras, 400 jobs. I mean, you can't beat those numbers. $131 million investment. That should be a good project for a lot of people, and I think people are real excited about it. But the independents as well. I mean, they typically use a lot of homegrown talent and crew, and that helps them as well.
Margaret O'Reilly is the director of the Michigan Film Office. Margaret, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
The MSU Museum has two new photo exhibitions that display the work life of people around the globe. One is called An Extraordinary Document of Our World. The other is Detroit Resurgent. The Detroit Project will be turned into a book from the MSU Press next year. MSU President Luanna Simon will help officially open the exhibitions Wednesday at 5 p.m. Current State Scott Pohl visited the museum last week to have a look, and he joins us this morning to tell us about his tour. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Mark.
Tell us about this is a French photographer behind these two exhibitions. Tell us about him.
That's right. His name is Gilles Perron, and for more than a quarter of a century, he's gone everywhere you can think of with his wife and collaborator, Nicole Ivanchik, taking portraits of thousands of people. They're striking black and white photos, and until the company stopped making it, they used large format Polaroid film. When they separated the positive image from the negative, they would give the positive to the subject and use the negative for future prints. The two of them were at the museum when I stopped by last week, along with MSU journalism professor Howard Bawson. They've become friends, and Bawson curated these exhibits. Gilles' English isn't strong, and Nicole did some interpreting for me. She started by telling me about their work.
So, and you can imagine, it takes time. It can take 5 minutes to half an hour to have one portrait. So, and we take time to meet people, to talk, to exchange, even beyond the words. Because just standing in front of a camera for 5 minutes is already something. And you obviously you give something to the photographer and he gives something to you.
Il faut préciser que j'organise la prise de vue comme une cérémonie.
He organizes the shooting as a ceremony, really, and that is important, very important to him.
Some of Gilles' subjects are very ordinary people, and some are extraordinary people. So why don't we maybe go in the gallery and we can talk about that range of people a little bit, as well as some favorites.
Okay.
One of the things that Gilles has photographed from time to time is, you know, we talk about work, but he also focuses sometimes on the work that children have to do. And this photograph of this agricultural worker from Egypt is actually, it's in the exhibition because I wanted to make sure there was at least one photograph of child labor in the exhibition.
How old is this child?
10 years.
10 years old? Mm. Yeah. And so I explained it takes time to make a portrait, but the person who was in charge of the work just said, well, have you finished now? Because she must go back to work. And that was terrible for us, really terrible.
Et puis, quand on lui a donné la photo, les garçons lui ont volé pour la déchirer.
Oh. So I explained we always give back the picture, and the boys working with her just took the picture and teared it off.
Oh.
And I was really, I'm still moved.
A young girl working in agriculture in Egypt, and her name is Mona Badawi Al-Sharouri.
Yes.
In Egypt.
Yeah, that was 1998.
The portrait we're in front of right now is of a portrait of General Wang Zheng, who was a companion of Mao Zedong during the 1934-1935 Long March. He became the ambassador of the People's Republic of China to France, Canada, Hungary, Indonesia, and Egypt. He was the PRC's first ambassador to the United Nations. And most remarkably, he helped prepare the way for President Richard Nixon's famous 1972 visit to China. So historically, a pretty important person, but no more important in, I think, Gilles' eyes and Nicole's eyes than this young militiaman from the Hmong tribe that was made much more recently, a young man by the name of Poe.
Leonard O'Leary is a fisherman. This was taken in Ireland in 2007, a striking image.
Yeah, at that time we were commissioned on a work called People of the Sea, so in County Cork. So we drove around all along the sea, and we knew all areas. And he was just staring at me. I was just staring at him. And Gilles said, okay, let's go on. Can I just photograph him? Do you think it's time? And we were laughing each other beyond the words.
These come from the late 1990s in Egypt. And what I found so striking about them when Gilles talks about going to a place where there's rapid social change occurring, this pair really kind of exemplifies that. One of the images we're looking at is a woman called Mabruka. Is that
pronounced?
Mabruka, who is an embroiderer of trousseaus. And as we can see, she is seated here, completely covered with her own embroidered work. Actually, the only part of her body I think we can see at all are some fingers and some toes. She really exemplifies the old traditional society. And right next to her is a woman by the name of Dina El Said, who likes to be called Charlie. And she is the first female pilot at Egypt Air. And in the portrait, she's sort of looking directly at us. She's in her the seat in the cockpit of her plane. Her hat is sort of laid in her lap. She's looking very confident, very much in control of things. And it just sort of struck me that these two pictures, when paired, really sort of tell us about the world, at least the old world, and I guess the new world for women. And I thought that was a very important thing to get into this exhibition.
Before we go elsewhere, I want to ask how the Detroit Project fits in with the rest of your work. What appealed to you about the project that you undertook in Detroit called Detroit Resurgent, Portraits of the Motor City?
Until now, we never photographed American people or workers.
There are some fabulous stories in Detroit about people doing really interesting things, some at sort of the higher levels, like people who run fairly sizable companies, or Bob King, who's the president of the United Auto Workers, but also, again, like with the extraordinary document, lots of ordinary people who are urban farmers and who are artists, cooks, and people who started entrepreneurial businesses, like Anne Perot, one of the co-founders of the Avalon International Breads in Detroit. So we thought those were important things to try to do, because to create kind of the counter narrative about Detroit that it's, you know, all ruins. We bought Nicole an audio recorder and asked her to ask a common set of just a few questions. People then start talking, it gets the ball rolling. And so Nicole recorded interviews with all of the subjects that two of my students spent the last academic year transcribing. Those interviews will all be in the book, Detroit Resurgent. And what we have here in the gallery, because you can't put an interview on the wall, we have these touch screens. We have all of the subjects up here. And we have taken a piece of their interviews. In this way, we can kind of display all 62 portraits and at least a portion of the interviews that'll be in the book. So it's a way for people to get all of that information and to see all the portraits, because we only have space for 36 of the actual prints.
One of the Detroit photos that appeals to me is Monique Watson, who works in an auto factory. She's got a big smile on her face in the photo. I think people think of auto factory work as being drudgery, hard work. Not to say that it isn't, but she seems to be enjoying herself in the photo that you have of her. Can you tell me about your encounter with her?
She was very happy to be photographed, and she enjoys working at the Chevy Volt.
She talks about how her mother also works in the auto industry, and that, you know, it was very interesting to sort of hear about the two generations. When that interview was conducted, she was finishing up her maternity leave, so she talks very much about her pride as an auto worker and her how the auto industry, particularly in terms of the advanced technology cars, like, you know, the Volt, how that's really changing the world's perception of the auto industry, and that she's so proud to be part of, you know, of that endeavor.
Another thing that strikes me about the Detroit portraits in the exhibition are that they're not just the auto industry. People think about the auto industry, and maybe they think about music when they think about Detroit. But we have bakers here. We have plastic surgeons, all with ties to the city of Detroit.
Designer also.
Wonderful. That, furniture.
Yeah,
maker and designer.
Yeah. Alan Kanyas is an incredible furniture designer. And so we could sit on his different chairs and armchairs, and they are incredibly comfortable. We started this work on Detroit, and we met incredibly interesting people, really, really, all of them. Sometimes we're very, very tired, because it was tough time going from one place to another, meeting people, not knowing who they were. And after each interview, we just came out of that watching each other and saying, oh, that's incredible. These are incredible people. And the main thing is that they help each other, and none of them is working on his own. They work with the community, all of them. And this is so different from what we have in Europe, at least in France.
Howard Bossen is a professor of journalism at Michigan State University and curated this exhibit. Nicole Levenchik and Gilles Perron, thank you all so much for taking me around the exhibits here at the MSU Museum.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll take a look at Move to Amend. Move to Amend is a coalition against the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the Citizens United case. Also, we hear from Ellie's Place in Lansing, and we speak with members of Manual Cinema, a shadow puppet ensemble from Chicago. Coming up Friday on Current State, live music in Studio S here at WKAR, commemorating the Old Town Blues Festival coming up this weekend. Frog and Matchett perform our music live on Friday here on Current State. Worth listening to. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, to Aaron Young for engineering, and to Gabrielle Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.